everyone. My name is Marie Cartier, and I'm a professor of queer studies and gender women's studies at California State University, Northridge. And you are welcomed to Lost and Salvaged Archives and Letters, Disasters, Discoveries, and Rescues. So if this is not your session, vacate your seat. Otherwise, you're in the right session. And the way we're going to do this is we have four papers. They will each take 15 minutes, which will leave us a half hour at the end for questions. I am just going to introduce each person and with their introduction and the name of their paper, and that's it. And then they'll read their paper. We'll go through the four, and then we'll open it up for questions. Okay? So first, I am very pleased to introduce Olaf Kristrom, and his bio is that he is a queer activist, a private collector, and a public librarian, as well as a founding member since 2017 and a board member of the Archives and Library of the Queer Movement, QRAV, in Gothenburg, Sweden. And his paper is entitled Lone Heroes or Durable Communities, Reflections on the Image of Queer History, Workers, or One More Enemy of Books. Please welcome him.
Thank you, Marie. There's no microphone here, and as you heard, I work as a librarian, and I try to scream at you. And if you can't hear what I say, just wave the hand. Welcome, everyone. I'm very glad you're all here to listen to this presentation, and I'm super excited to hear the other papers later. My name is Olaf Kristrom, and I'm here representing QRAV, which was founded just about a year and a half ago in Gothenburg, Sweden. So we're a young organization, but I hope I can give you some reflections that might resonate with those who have longer experience in the field of queer history and queer heritage. First of all, I would also like to apologize for the title. It's a bit misleading. When I got the title of the session, I refocused my talk a little to speak more about the salvaging, the rescuing part of what I was going to say. So I will talk a little bit about the image of the queer history worker at the end, but we'll get to that later. And so I added the extra subtitle, One More Enemy of Books. So in 1880, the British bibliophile William Blades listed what he thought of as the enemies of the books. As you see, it's a list marked by a certain time and a certain society. I'm thinking, for example, of the enemies of gas and servants, maybe not universal problems. I will touch on ignorance a bit later, but for the story I will tell you today, the list is inadequate. Which is why I have made a revision, adding one more enemy of books: rent increases.
Oh, nice.
To make my point, I thought I'd share the story of the library of RFSL, Sweden's oldest... Oh my, it doesn't look good. Sweden's oldest and biggest LGBTQ organization. Seen in this picture is a view of the library in Stockholm from, I'm guessing, by the computer, the late 90s. The library was founded in the 1950s. RFSL started in 1950, and soon they gathered a book collection for the use of members, not least the members outside of the big cities who could get books sent to them through mail. During the 1980s and 1990s, the collection grew, primarily through the bookstore that RFSL ran in Stockholm, where they purchased duplicates of the stock for the bookstore through the library. So in the end, there were some 8,000 to 10,000 volumes in the library. A full account of the library is no longer possible. In 2013, the city of Stockholm decided to sell the office building where RFSL had their offices to a private company. When notice of rent increases was given in 2017, they decided to move offices and downsize, and the library was one of the things that they didn't have room for in their new offices. There was a catalog once upon a time, but it was just on one server, and there was a computer crash some years ago. So no one really knows what was in the library anymore. But even if the library is no more, some of the individual books survive. Representatives of the Royal Library, Sweden's National Library, were contacted to come and see if they wanted to add something to their collections. In the end, 345 titles were donated to the Royal Library. Some university libraries were also contacted, but few were interested, really. 144 titles went to the library of the Linnaeus University in Växjö, Sweden. A collection of HIV/AIDS related materials went to the Karolinska Institute, also in Stockholm. And then by pure chance, actually, CUREB, which was just about to hold its first statutory meeting, we heard of the disbandment. And just with a few days' notice, I went to Stockholm and collected 562 titles from RFSL to the new CUREB library. What was left was some 7,000 to 9,000 volumes that didn't make it up in publicly accessible collections, and they were sold at clearance. And what was left after that was given to the City Mission, who runs secondhand stores. And the City Mission's policy on books is that they send most of it to recycling, which is burning. In summary, about 10% of the library was saved somehow and is accessible through the Royal Library, the University Libraries, or CUREB. And it's important to think that half of what was saved went to state-funded libraries, and half of it went to a grassroots organization barely founded and not at all funded. And those were the numbers of the books. Then you might ask, was there anything of interest in the library? Was it worth saving? One way of answering those questions is to look at what was unique in the holdings, at least in a Swedish context. This diagram shows the ratio of titles that was previously not held by libraries affiliated with the national catalog, Libris, in Sweden. So, as you see, of the books that I took to CUREB, about 433 were not held by other libraries, which is about 77%, shown in pink on the bar. The Royal Library, the ratio is worse for them, 124 unique titles, which means 36%. And I might add that they were the first to take their pick. So everything that I took, they missed. Of the 144 titles that went to the Linnaeus University, 39, or 27%, were not previously held by Libris Library. But then, unique isn't always interesting. And what's interesting isn't the same for everybody. But to give you just a glimpse of what I thought was interesting and worth saving in the RFSL Library, I thought I'd show you a few of the titles that are now held at CUREB. In going through the shelves, I had about 5-6 hours before my train went back to Gothenburg. I tried to focus on a few themes. global perspectives, lesbian feminism, and, for example, bibliographies as well. Mm. So these are a few of the bibliographies that you now can see at QRAB. Mm. Going to individual titles, here we have the frontrunner, Patricia Nelvorens, groundbreaking gay novel, published in Swedish in 1977, with illustrations by Tom of Finland. Illustrations which, as far as I can tell, hasn't been used in any other edition. And as a book printed in Sweden, one copy should have gone to the Royal Library as a legal deposit. But the publishers who mainly produced gay porn weren't that interested in sending legal deposits, I guess. There's also interest in provenances. In this picture, you see a copy of gay publishing pioneer Friedrich Radsweit's novel Männer zu verkaufen, Men for Sale. It's a rarity in its own right, but turning to the title page, we also find the signature of Erik Thorssell, one of the founders of RFSL, who in 1932 went to Berlin to study at the Institute for Sexual Science, just outside these walls, and bought this book on his journey. Finally, and also relating to the Institute for Sexual Science, we have two issues of the Mitteilungen des Wissenschaftlichen Humanitären Komitees, the publication of the first public gay rights organization. I wouldn't presume to characterize the librarians from the Royal Library going through the first handpick, but missing titles such as these, at least to me, seems to border on ignorance. But everything else aside, we were at least very happy at QRAB to provide a new home for these books and others. And so it seems were other people. Pretty soon QRAB was contacted by the media trying to get a comment on the disbandment. It had gotten some attention in the press, the disbandment of the library. And it was portrayed as RFSL throwing their history away. We were interviewed, resulting in articles like this, which is from the major newspaper of Gothenburg. Having given a couple of interviews, we discovered that some common themes emerged in the covering of the issue. One of the main ones was individualization. The story of me going by train to Stockholm to rescue certain unique books was seen as very fascinating. And the bigger story of the causes of the library being disbanded was downplayed. And connected to that theme is the theme of heroization, of the lone hero rescuing the special history. But no one phoned the landlord to ask them questions about why they did rent increases, or the members of the city council to ask why they sold the house and didn't provide fundings for the rent increase. We were also contacted by the city museum at Mölndal, a small city just outside of Gothenburg, who wanted to do an exhibition centered around the rescuing of the books. QRAB agreed, but tried to widen the exhibition to include all of our collections. And we also wrote the info signs for the exhibition. So we tried to give a more nuanced description of what happened. If you see in the picture here, in the corner you see the museum insisted on the bags that the books were collected in. They must be in the exhibition. So we put them in a corner there and wrote an info sign starting with a quote, "The enemies of books are fire, water, dust, and thieves, and rent increases." That's really all I have time for. but in concluding, I would like to offer a word in the way of wisdom on how we all can try to make better the understanding of what goes into the work of queer history. I think we need to tell the stories of our collections as well as the stories in our collections. That is, explain what circumstances and efforts that make the preservation of sharing and sharing of queer history possible, or what makes it difficult. Because the work and labor of queer history is itself also queer history.
That's Thank so great. You. So our next presenter is Carolyn DeCruz, and Carolyn is a senior lecturer in the Gender, Sexuality, and Diversity Studies program, and has grown cobwebs in her brain from thinking, writing, and teaching about identity politics since the 1990s. She is the author of Identity Politics in Deconstruction, Calculating with the Incalculable, and co-editor of After Homosexual, The Legacies of Gay Liberation. And today she will be presenting a paper, The Lesbian History Archives Letter from Radcliffe Hall, Making Sense of Stephen in the Well of Loneliness for Today's Alphabet. So please help me in welcoming her.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for coming. As a handmade sign at the Brooklyn Lesbian History Archives, probably as old as the archives itself, that says more about history than most official textbooks. It reads, "In memory of the voices we have lost." For any of you who just saw the archivettes, you would have just seen that. My question, how can we memorialise something that is lost? Let's ponder that as I go on. Perhaps the sign reminds us that most of what we think we know is just a trace of what will always remain inaccessible. When this thought dawns on us, memory making becomes so much more precious. The founders and workers of the Lesbian History Archives have given us the gift of voices to work with, raw materials from which we construct memory for those who are invested in or need to learn about a thing we can loosely call lesbian inheritance and culture. Making sense of who we think we are is not easy for a minor culture. We have to build our own canons of knowledge. The informal canon of lesbian literature was passed on to me in the late 1980s through friends and grassroots networks, rather than any formal institution like the academy, school, university. And among the books recommended were The Well of Loneliness, The Ruby Fruit Jungle, Stone Butch Blues, Califia's Sophistries, and I bought myself a copy of Pleasure and Danger, edited by Carol Vance, the book version of the notorious Ninth Conference of the Scholar and Feminist held in 1982 at Barnard College in New York. I can talk about that later if you want. Now, from this list, the book I could never get through as a young dyke was The Well of Loneliness. I just could not see myself as Stephen, and you can see why by looking at me. And then my girlfriend at the time introduced me to Joan Nessel's work. Yeah, lust, tenderness, love, clothes, including V-necks and slips in particular, the grittiness of everyday life and work, a working class lesbian who could love herself as well as others. Stephen didn't love herself very much. I'm not setting up Joan Nessel against Radcliffe Hall as if one offers better lesbian identification than another, though that was the personal case when I was going through my own queer reading rites of passage. Yeah, we've all got to find that at some stage of our lives. I needed my personal experience and sense of self validated when I was first coming out. And that's one of the reasons why Nessel's voice was able to reach me in a way that Hall's never would. But now I read Hall, and for other reasons. I don't need the personal narrative so much. I returned to reading Hall after visiting the Lesbian History Archives in 2016. from the LHA, I got a pamphlet produced by Polly Thistle Quaid, who you might have seen if you just watched that movie, for the Lesbian Herstory Educational Foundation, containing Radcliffe Hall's 1934 letter about the Well of Loneliness. And in going back to the well, I wasn't now looking for myself. This time, I was interested in what Hall gives all of us in this room, even if you're a pufta, in the alphabet soup. Sorry for that language, even if you're a gay male. Sometimes I forget if I'm social or professional, it just happens that way. But it gives all of us in the alphabet soup something to think about heritage and identity, all of us. Of all the labels attached to Hall, my favourite is misfit. Before welcoming a certain kind of misfit, though, I'd like to point out that there's nothing inherently good or bad about not fitting or fitting. If I dwell in these passages on the portrait of Hall as a misfit, it is to examine the benefits of being dislocated, of not making sense of yourself. Misfits tell us a lot about normativity, power, and the templates set up for anybody to feel a sense of belonging. Writing to a lover, Eugenia, sorry for my pronunciation, Soline, in 1934, Hall says, "I have been called the writer of misfits, and it may be that being myself a misfit, for as you know, beloved, I am a born invert," that's her words, "it may be that I am a writer of misfits in one form or another. I think I understand them, their joys and their sorrows. Indeed, I know I do, and all the misfits of this world are lonely, being conscious that they differ from the rank and file." This extract is taken from Jana Funke's recent anthology, The World and Other Unpublished Works of Radcliffe Hall. So let's think about the other labels that get attached to Hall. My own copy of The Well has the words 1920s lesbian classic scrawled across its cover. The main character, Stephen Gordon, though, in recent times has been claimed and disavowed as lesbian, transgender, pre-transsexual and queer. All of those words have been used by different scholars to claim Hall and Stephen. The fact there has been so much contestation over the identity of Stephen can be quite enlightening for thinking through current tensions within our alphabet soup and how we reread canonical texts like this to remember, yes, quite literally think again about what constitutes membership for taking care of our legacies, and more importantly, think about what solidarity building we can turn toward when we focus on misfits. Opportunity here. So to return to that LHA pamphlet I held in my hand on that afternoon 2 years ago, in it, Polly Thistlethwaite writes a short introduction to the reproduction of the letter, revealing that it came to the Herstory archives by way of a New York City man who found the letter in his deceased parents' closet. Yes, closet. Thistlethwaite notes that apart from reflecting on love, sexuality and society, the well also betrays brands of racism, classism and anti-Semitism. We've got to reckon with that when we're claiming Radcliffe Hall. And I'd like to explore that down the track. For now, though, I note that the letter about the well is written to Gorham Munson, a literary scholar, who presumably sent Hall a series of questions to which he responds. Thinking about heritage, memory and solidarity, how we read a situation historically and think about what we want to cultivate from that to make a more just world, it's noteworthy that Hall underscores that she waited till she had a name for herself as an author before writing the well. She believed an unknown author would not have found a publisher for a novel of what she calls, her words, congenital sexual inversion. And I think she's right. Hall outlines her own qualifications to write, in addition to being an accomplished novelist, as a person who, her words, understood the subject from the inside as well as from the medical and psychological textbooks. Now, of course, the landscape in which we can discuss LGBTIQ plus identities has complicated and broadened from the signposts of personal experience on the one hand and the appointed experts in medicine and psychiatry on the other hand. Paul's letter to Monthan refers to the commentary slotted at the beginning of the 1928 British edition of The Well, which was written by none other than Havelock Ellis, the 19th century expert on inversion and homosexuality, and wait for it, as well as supporter of eugenics. I don't know how many of you were given the leaflet this morning by the anti-fascist telling us about Magnus Hirschfeld and his relation to eugenics and racism, something else I think we need to reckon with as we're having a conference under his name. The 1920s and 1930s, of course, are before the days when we as scholars and activists questioned language and the cultivation of types of people that served the building of empires and nations. Questions and work that is integral to what we learn and teach about gender, sexuality, race, and other forms of identity today. So still, I do think it's unfortunate how recourse to the congenital, you know, the born this way trope, like, you know, we know more popularly through Lady Gaga, and reliance on medical psychiatric experts to talk about sexual orientation and gender diversity, it persists way too much in way too many circles at present, I think. There's still more people who share the view of congenital conditions than there are those who focus on the history of categories we acquire to understand ourselves. So to quote from Hall's letter, the aim to portray in Stephen Gordon the finest type of inverted woman, knowing well that such a type does in fact exist side by side with the weaker members, reminds me all too much and too painfully of how the need to be considered as good, these are her words again, and useful citizens as the best of the so-called normal men and women of society remains today with all its heteronormative, classist and racial biases. We witnessed this in the marriage campaign in Australia in 2017, and you know, incidentally, Hall talks about her desire for marriage in this letter. And I wince at Hall's division between good and bad inverts, not to take away the courage and gift that the Well of Loneliness continues to bring so many of us. I say it to remember and remind future generations and us today that a heritage always involves a task. It involves work. It's not a heritage if we're not working for it. So we choose what and how we want to carry legacies and build solidarity. The two things I emphasise in discussing the challenge of heritage building then is first what the book has meant and can still mean for individual readers making sense of themselves, ourselves. And second, the book gives us an inheritance for what we choose to work upon for writing history and cultivating the kind of world we want to live in now and the future. The inheritance of Stephen Gordon's identity has been claimed by different segments of our ever-expanding alphabet soup and has become the focus of some academic debate. Now, rather than trying to settle on the rightful heirs, it's more productive to think about each of us, how each of us might be differently invested in what Stephen Gordon has meant and can mean for those of us with a stake in their identity. It is not as if there is any easy ownership over Stephen's identity by lesbians, trans folk or non-binary folk, as the word Hall mostly uses for Stephen and for herself is the medical language of invert. The question is not one of settling on an identity for Stephen, but working through what kinds of experience the character presents to readers through different spaces and times. There are bound to be more memories whose voices are lost in their reading of Stephen than are accessible to us. But here is where this beautifully crafted lesbian herstory archive in the form of the LHA pamphlet, which, you know, I can hold, where is it, so lightly in my hands, gives us more weight to carry in our understanding of history. On the back of the pamphlet is a short bibliography on Radcliffe Hall, which includes a list of her published works, as well as selected books and articles written about Hall and her work. So directly following the bibliography in small print, there's a note that in 1985, the Lesbian Herstory Archive conducted a survey to lesbians on our mailing list about experiences of reading The Well, and the responses were published in the 986 LHA newsletter. Why I love archivists. I got to this in five clicks. Archive gold. a whole series of people who shared their experiences of what it was like to read The Well from like the 1930s to the 1980s. And if you saw the archive it's just then, you would have heard about the Polish woman in a concentration camp, 12 years old, dreaming of the day where when she read The Well, to kiss another woman's lips. Okay, so I'm thankful that we have these voices, and their reading is alive and well, in the archive at least. This is why we need the archives and need to support them. And so I'd like to now, though, like, in light of these experiences and everything I've said, I'm not going to quote you any of the words because we've only got 15 minutes, but I can do that later, is actually reflect on the neologism of herstory in the archiving, because this is where I got it from, the herstory archives. So the herstory, and this is my final bit, the herstory neologism reminds me of my own lesbian feminist days in a way that doesn't make me wince like so many other things of that time does. I love how these archives played with language so that we could rename ourselves as we called attention to how power was operating through us. And there was actually a little bit in the archivettes, if you haven't seen that, about the naming of herstory and someone saying it should be history because herstory is not a word. Right? And so I'd like to close by suggesting another neologism, because I like bastardising language, that puts us in touch with our heritage and aspirations for solidarity. We are, all of us, heirs to this archive. The work we have before us is one in which Stephen's identity is and will remain contested, as the conflation of gender and sexuality, as it was studied and written about at the time, lends us no easy binary from which we can fully separate history from herstory and all that falls between and beyond what people understand to be his and hers. So to keep the herstory of Radcliffe Hall legible against the non-negotiable dominant language of history, we largely have no choice in that, and to allow for all the misfits that have identified with Stephen Gordon and all the misfits who wanted to identify with Stephen Gordon but were just way too femme and couldn't find their sustenance in this particular well, there is a space in which we can think together now about what I want to call our heirstories, H-E-I-R, heirs. Heirs, we're all heirs to this, and keep on building on what needs to be done so that oppressive closets can turn into fabulous wardrobes of more gender possibilities, complete with the back door to Fantasyland. Thank you.
Our next presenter is John Tubera, and John is a PhD student in Cultural Studies and Religion at Claremont Graduate University in Claremont, California. He serves on the leadership committee of Seamen, California Men, Enjoying Naturism. As administrator and cinema moderator, his current dissertation explores the work of AIDS memory in a time of erasure of urban queer spaces resulting from gentrification. And just on a personal note, I know John, and I've gone to every OMS except the first one because I didn't know about it. And this is your first OMS, right?
Yes.
And so I think it's very fabulous to see OMS growing. And I knew John when he was an undergraduate before he went to graduate school. So it's really exciting that people are finding about this conference. And I mean, it's like doubling in size. John's presentation today is Salvaging Memory Through the Malibu Fires.
Thank you, Marie. Got the title. Okay. On November 8th, 2018, an inauspicious fire ignited in the difficult mountain terrain of Malibu, a suburb located on the outskirts of Los Angeles. The fire started in the Woodsy Canyon area and were spread by hot Santa Ana winds blowing at 113 kilometers per hour. Around 5:30 a.m. the next day, the Woolsey fire had jumped the 101 Ventura Freeway, which you see right there. It's a busy corridor serving commuters from Los Angeles to San Francisco. In the span of 6 hours, the fire raced through the Malibu Hills and reached the Pacific Ocean some 35 kilometers away. In its wake, the Woolsey Fire burned 40,000 hectares, destroyed 1,500 structures, and 340 homes and ranches. One structure that was ravaged by the Woolsey Fire was a Jewish retreat center that hosts youth camps for schools and nonprofit religious organizations. SEAMEN, California Men Enjoying Naturism, an organization comprised of gay and bisexual men who enjoy and practice nudity, has held annual retreats at this center for the last 20 years. Three large shipping containers that were stored on site that contained SEAMEN memorabilia and artifacts were either destroyed or damaged by the fire. From this particular incident, I was drawn to pose the following questions. What happens when artifacts are destroyed? How do artifacts connect with memory? And what is memory recruited to do as an organization seeks to rethink its traditions, identity, and future in a place which no longer exists? First, a little background on SEAMEN. SEAMEN hosts several retreats for naturist men across the United States, and the largest being the West Coast Gathering held in Malibu at this retreat center. About 350 to 450 men attend this gathering, and they come mainly from California and across the United States, while some attendees do come from Europe and Asia. The average age of most of the men skewed towards the mid-40s through mid-60s, so we're not talking 20-year-old bods here. So that historically places these men at a place where they know how to perform their heterosexuality. They've performed as heterosexuals. They served in the military, got married and had children. They divorced and came out as gay, while others chose to live openly gay lives. Older men have lived through the ravages of the AIDS epidemic and have buried lovers and friends, while others are living as HIV-positive gay men. The following interdisciplinary work frames my discussion today, and these are just some of the things that I grapple with. The epistemology of the archives, trauma and memory studies, queer geographies of sexual communities, and cultural memory and memory work. As someone new to the field of archival studies, I understand that the term archive is a very contested term. The traditional view, the one that I understand from Derrida, that the archive is an institutional space for the collection of memories, of documents, contrasts with Foucault's more abstract conception of the archives as a system of formation and transformation of statements. One, quote, that governs the appearance of statements as unique events, end quote. Foucault situates the term archives within his broader work on archaeology, which is an analytical tool used for the uncovering of historical statements or systems of knowledge. And perhaps one way to, for me anyway, to restate this from a Foucauldian analysis is to say that the archives the material of the archives that are constituted encompass not only physical documents and documents of historical significance, but also cultural artifacts whose meanings are unearthed through discursive investigations. I take this broader view of the archive as archiving culture and the archiving of common and everyday scenarios. And so I'd like to kind of explore a little bit about the everyday storage units of the SEAMEN organization. The three shipping containers that were destroyed housed a range of commonplace everyday items, such as a cinema marquee, audio systems and projection screens, stage equipment and decorations for nightly events, such as game shows, beauty pageants, contests, a boutique of donated thrift store dresses, shoes, jewelry, and accessories, boxes of unused condoms, pool equipment such as swimming noodles and umbrellas, swag bags consisting of semen clothing, merchandise, and memorabilia that we give out to the members. According to Wagoner, items of memorabilia constitute cultural tools that mediate memory, what Wagoner calls culture in action. And for the gay and bisexual men who congregate to this campsite every September, these items mediate a particular constellation of memories. Early mornings engage in activities from naked lap swimming or yoga. Afternoons filled with movie matinees or lounging in the pool while enjoying al fresco blowjobs. And evening participating in pageants crowning Mr. Leather and Miss Semen Queen. I argue that the items stored in these shipping containers represent an archive of this group's everyday practices and rituals, and also function as tools for the mediation of memory. So given Wagoner's sense of culture tools and memory, my question is, what work is memory recruited to do in this particular instance? I'd like to share probably just two examples. The first is that a notable response that emerged was the expression of resilience in the midst of grief and loss. One retreat website was this post from one of the camp administrators. Many years ago, a fire blackened the hillside down Mulholland. I remember vividly the following year after the rains, driving by and looking to see the most colorful blanket of wildflowers I had ever seen. We too will turn our ashes into blossoms. Similarly, semen members posted on their private Facebook group page how they were processing this loss. Yes, the fires in Malibu have apparently taken down most of the facilities at camp, but semen is not a particular facility nor a particular place. Yes, semen is portable within us. We can set up camp anywhere. It is not a place, but a state of being. This trope of resilience stood in stark contrast to what semen leaders experienced during their attempt to salvage storage items. After 5 months of unusual heavy rains, which made visiting the camp difficult because of the mountainous the dirt that came down, semen was finally given permission to visit the campsite to survey the damage. When we inquired about taking pictures or videos to document our experience, the camp emphatically stated that absolutely no photographs of the campsite were allowed and no interviews with camp staff were to be given. So on the day of our visit to the camp, we knew that our goal was to salvage and to inventory what was there. But after 2 hours into our project, the camp director met with our team, and he said to us that what was there needs to be taken into our cars, and if there is anything that cannot fit, it would be destroyed and burned. After we salvaged what could fit in our cars, one of the semen leaders involved in the salvaging process wrote this email. Removing items from a fire-scorched container reminded me of the last fire recovery I helped with at my grandfather's house in Pennsylvania. His attic suffered the most damage, and as a young man at the time I stored them, he is referring to my entire photo collection of me as a ballet dancer. Nothing was saved from the ravages of that fire, but the acrid smoky ash-filled smells of the Malibu fire returned fire memories while I was helping emptying the semen containers. Hogg sees memory work as a reconstruction process where underlying assumptions beneath the scraps of memory must be explored in order to uncover other visible meanings, paths, and possibilities. She quotes, "They become manifest as contradictions, as disharmony, as ruptures, as incongruities." So in discursive statements such as "we will rebuild" or the sense of resilience in the face of grief, when historicized within the context of contemporary Southern California, memory works to advance the view that not only the human spirit, but the California human spirit is an indomitable in the face of a landscape rift with earthquakes, wildfires, and floods. Also, by refusing seamen the opportunity to take pictures, this limits the time frame to even salvage our items, and it also nullifies the process of our own grieving. One more quote. Weeks after the camp was destroyed, several on the seamen leadership team jumped into action and visited potential campsites in the Southern California area. And so the planning committee was tasked with the sense of how do we move a camp and all its tradition to a new location. One of the ways that we did it was to figure out what were some of the rituals and to readapt it to this new space. So this is in reference to social hour events that we have every afternoon. And this is kind of the description of it. What could be more memorable than our Malibu gatherings? Recycle your favorite fabulous gathering attire for a retro look, or create a new one from collected plastic bottles, soda cans, and other reusable paraphernalia. Relive your past glory days by parading in your winning pageantry crown and sash, or in that oh-so-unmemorable talent, no-talent game show Project Runway costume. Here, I reference Sember's work on queer geographies that have an interplay between place and space and community rituals. He writes, space consists of more than the objective geography they inhabit. Instead, they are locations within time and are the unsettled product of a particular performative configurations of history, form, and function. In conclusion, I find comfort and encouragement in Feldman's charge to, quote, write through that which seems an impossibility. For perhaps in a small way, the work that memory is recruited to do in the face of the devastation experienced in the Woolsey Fire is to work through the equivocations of loss and resilience, and to hold in tension the view that a community's memory is both scarred yet deepened by these experiences. Thank you.
Thank you. Not least, we have Runar Kvartil, and he is a historian with a PhD from the University of Bergen. His research focus is on queer Norwegian history, especially the criminalization of sex between men until 1972, and the treatment of homosexuality in 19th and 20th centuries. Jordan is currently a senior academic librarian at the Norwegian Queer Archive since 2014 at the University of Bergen Library. And today he will be presenting, I, of course, take for granted that this, like my other letters, will be burned. Queer memory and loss in Norway. Please help me in welcoming him.
Oh, sure. Thank you. I'm just trying to get this to work. Yeah, thank you for the introduction. I'm working at the Norwegian Queer Archives, as you said. It's in Norwegian, it's called Skeivt arkiv. I start right on. In June 1892, just a moment. In June 1892, Norwegian historian Ebbe Hatzberg wrote a letter to his Danish friend Poul André after having read an article by him just recently published in the leading Danish medical journal. And this article was published under a pseudonym, and the topic was homosexuality. And both Hatzberg and André defined themselves as Uranians, or homosexuals. And Hatzberg wrote about the article André had just published, quote, "You have broken the ice here in the Nordic countries, and by this demonstrated that the waters could be passable also for others. And not only that, you have also, through your argumentation, removed several of the worst ice floes blocking the path, and thereby made it impossible for prejudices to freeze over again and form as impenetrable a wall as before," end quote. So what Hatzberg praised here with his wonderful Arctic metaphors was André's presentation of homosexuality as an inborn and natural condition. Mm. The article was one of the first works about the topic in Scandinavia, and both Herzberg and André had found inspiration in the new essentialist model of homosexuality presented in German sexology by psychiatrists like Karl Westphal and Richard von Krafft-Ebing. I will come back to Herzberg's letters to André. But let me first give a brief presentation of Eber Herzberg and of the state of knowledge as it was before these letters were found. So first, just a very brief introduction of Paul André. He was the son of an important politician in Denmark, and he studied law at the Copenhagen University. And at the time that he wrote this article in 1892, he held a high position as a civil servant. But 2 years later, in 1894, he resigned, and he lived the rest of his life as an independent, living on the family fortune. And Eber Herzberg, like André, he came from the privileged upper classes in Scandinavia. He was born in a small town at the Oslofjord, called Holmestrand, in 1847. He was a talented student of history and law, and he became a professor at the university in Oslo when he was only 30 years old. He had also worked as a diplomat in Paris, and he was even a member of the Norwegian government cabinet for a short period in 1884. So to put it short, André and Herzberg, they had a lot of common. They were highly educated. They were from the upper classes, from the elite, and they knew, for example, they knew several foreign languages. So here you see the title of an article about homosexuality in old Scandinavian law and tradition that was published in Magnus Hirschfeld's Yearbook of Intermediate Sexual Types in 1902. The author was anonymous, but thanks to Raymond Wolfert, who sits back there, thanks to his research in the 1990s, we know that the author was Eber Herzberg. Einer norwegischen Gelehrten. That was Herzberg. And also, since the late 1990s, Norwegian historians, including myself, have also revealed that Herzberg in 1886 was a victim of blackmail and of rumors of having had sexual relations with working class men in Oslo. The rumors were so strong that Herzberg risked being discharged from the university. So desperately, he traveled to Berlin to see this guy, Karl Westphal, who was one of the leading German psychiatrists at the time. And Westphal examined and questioned Herzberg. Westphal is, as some of you know, is famous for coining the term contrary sexual feeling in 1869. And Herzberg's strategy was to convince the university directors back home in Oslo that his sexuality wasn't caused by lack of morality or low moralities. And he got what he wanted from Westphal. Westphal concluded that Herzberg suffered from a congenital desire towards his own sex, and this was present already in his childhood, and that was what he called contraire sexual empfindung. I have to apologize for not translating and for the incomplete sentences, but I'm sure you get the point. So because of this instinct, it was therefore no moral deficiency. Nothing Herzberg could control himself, according to Westphal, but a pathological natural instinct. So back in Oslo, Herzberg presented Westphal's declaration to the university directors, but his strategy didn't work, quite the opposite. They saw this declaration as a further proof that Herzberg was not suited to teach male young people. Herzberg was discharged. He worked as a freelance historian for some years, and he felt ostracized from the Norwegian society for the rest of his life. Although he finally got a new central position in 1906, becoming the director of the National Archives, a position he held until he died in 1912. So, to sum up, until some years ago, we knew about the scandal in 1886, we knew about Westphal's declaration, and we knew about Herzberg as the author of the article in Hirschfeld's yearbook in 1902. But we knew almost nothing about his own reflections about his sexuality, and we knew almost nothing about his contacts and what people he knew. So 10 years ago, I for the first time got a hint that there were more relevant material, that more relevant material had existed. I then discovered this short handwritten biographical sketch about Herzberg at the National Archives in Oslo. And this was written by a Norwegian historian named Halvdan Koht. And it was written in 1960. He was an old man. You see his handwriting is really, really shaky. But he knew Herzberg as a young man at the beginning of the century. And there he says, "I knew very well that he was a homosexual. I've seen letters from him to his Danish friend." And then there comes a word that is unreadable, where he writes openly about it and tells about homosexual adventures he had had. So the name of this Danish friend was simply unreadable, and this annoyed me. But anyway, I saw it as highly unlikely that these letters had survived anyway. So I didn't think very much about it until in 2013, I was contacted by the National Libraries in Oslo. They knew about my interest for Herzberg, and they could tell me that they had recently discovered an uncatalogued file in their storage room with letters from Herzberg to a Dane called Paul André. So then I got back to my notes, and of course, it is André. It's almost unreadable. It's up there, but it's I think it is André. Yeah. So for me, that was really exciting. I live in Bergen. I traveled to Oslo as soon as I could. The letters didn't disappoint me. But I will first say a few words about why did the letters survive. So, as quoted in the title of my presentation, Herzberg underlined to André that his letters should be burned. And André also put this into his will. But to make a long story short, the lawyer responsible for the belongings of André, he didn't do as André wanted. He instead gave them to an antiquarian bookstore in Copenhagen, and this bookseller offered them to the National Libraries in Norway, and at this point they let Halvdan Koht, the historian with the note, read them, and they decided to keep them, but not open them until 100 years after Herzberg's death. So that was in 2012. Wow. So, a wonderful history of heroic history, maybe, about archives. The letters survived. There were 13 of them. The first one is from 1892, and the last one is from 1906. But their correspondence started before, we don't know. It was not the first letter from 1892. But that's the first one that's kept. And these letters, they give us valuable information about the situation in Scandinavia at the time, but also about international acquaintances and contacts. For example, Herzberg briefly mentions Ferdinand Karsch Hack in Berlin, and he also mentioned Eugen Wilhelm in Strasbourg. That were two important figures close to Magnus Hirschfeld's Wissenschaftliche Humanitäre Komitee. But most importantly, the letters give us an interesting insight into how two Scandinavians were inspired by sexological literature by Krafft Ebing and others, but also how they criticize part of sexology. For example, Ebbe Hatzberg wrote in the first preserved letter, which is from 1892, I quote, but in my 5 minutes, yeah. But in my view, homosexuality is not a disease or a nervous disorder. The disease, on the contrary, is caused by the situation. The Uranian becomes neurasthenic because his abnormal situation is highly debilitating for the nerves. So it's society that makes the nervous disease. And these kinds of reflections make the letters very interesting source material in the ongoing research on how sexual identities were forged in dialogue and negotiation and also in conflict with psychiatrists and sexologists. In several places, Hatzberg describes the situation for homosexuals as even more oppressed in Norway than in Denmark. And I quote from one of his letters, quote, we are endlessly conservative and endlessly illiberal and intolerant up here. And this situation arguably has lasted at least until the last 1960s in Norway. And you can probably see conformity as the backside of the equality ideals of the Scandinavian welfare states. But at the same time, queer life did exist. The problem is that we only have very little preserved material of the time before 1970 in Norway. So the revolution in attitudes that started in the 1970s led to some interest for the queer Norwegian past, but much less than in our neighboring countries, Denmark and Sweden. And this was the situation that led us to start working to establish the Norwegian Queer Archive in 2012. A lot of the history hadn't been preserved in Norway, and we were afraid even more would get lost if nothing was done. And I have one more minute, two more, okay. our experience is that a specialized queer archive is crucial to prevent queer memory loss. And this is perhaps stating the obvious to you, but we still had a lot of resistance among Norwegian archivists to create this archive. They saw it as a segregated special interest archive and they didn't see the need for it. But the fact was that regular archive institutions hadn't had the focus, knowledge or interest to properly collect all relevant material. And to some degree they had also denied taking queer material into their collections. So to know the history and the relevant organizations and individuals is necessary to collect this history. You need an ongoing effort based on archivists who know the field very well. So the interplay of collecting archive material and oral histories has also been very productive for us, because when you interview people, you get to know more of the story and then you get to collect more of the materials. So during our short existence, lots of material have been collected and preserved that I'm sure otherwise would have been lost. So the relative acceptance of queer people in Norway is very recent. Until some decades ago, conformity and respectability norms were really, really strong in Norway. And the story of how the letters of Ebbe Hatzberg survived is a reminder of how fragile our history is, how traces of queer history have survived only by accident. The history of the queer movement in Norway has yet to be written in Norway. So very little has been done also by researchers and historians. And I think this is a very interesting situation because now everyone is celebrating Pride in Norway. It has become in every small little place in Norway, you're celebrating Pride. But at the same time, you don't know very much about the history of the situation. And I think that's a democratic problem in our country. But just to be a bit positive in the end, I can fit on this one, it seems finally to be changing. And I have half a minute. Yeah, okay. It seems to be changing. And I think the establishment of the Queer Archive has given a lot of attention to queer history. And we also see some attention from other institutions like the National Libraries and the National Museum. And although we are still looking for researchers and historians to do bigger project on this. At the archive, we have collected almost 300 shelf meters of archives, and we have also collected around 200 queer life stories on videotapes. So we hope that more research will come in the coming following years. So, okay. Then I have used 60 minutes, so I think I will stop there. Thank you.
So we're going to have about 25 minutes for questions, and I'm going to ask our panelists to bring their chairs up here. So nobody is displaced from their chair. Oh, they're all
together.
Oh, thank you. And I had one question that I was going to say for the end, but I think I will start it while you're thinking of your questions, and I'll give your panelists 30 seconds to answer. If you, in each one of them, just if you were to continue this research, where would it go? So if you could popcorn in each person, just say, or are you finished with this subject? Anybody? We can go in the order that we've presented if you feel comfortable.
Sure. Yeah. It's not really research that I've done. It's more like a mapping situation, because it would be really, really interesting to know more about what was in the library, particularly maybe fiction, where books aren't catalogued as queer books necessarily, but there's someone has seen a queer theme and put the book in the library, and then without the context of that specific library, no one sees the theme until they read the book. So knowing more about what books were lost would be great, but difficult.
Yeah, continue with the relationship between heritage and how people make sense of their own lived experiences. I'd be focusing on the other aspects of Radcliffe Hall, the classism, the racism that's a part of the Radcliffe Hall archive, but which people don't focus on because they're so much invested in the actual, you know, whoever's claiming Radcliffe Hall. Putting that again, though, next to the contradictions that it's never pure, it's always contaminated, and the same racist class, you know, like upper class person, is someone who spoke to a 12-year-old in a Polish concentration camp. So we've got to deal with all of those contradictions at the same time.
This particular project allowed me to engage in the research on memory and then archives, which I really did not have a background in, and I think it just fits in the larger research interests. I'm interested in, you know, AIDS memorials and memory, and so this kind of gave me an opportunity to at least get my feet into the literature.
Yeah, I would like to write an article about Andrei and Hertzberg, and then I would go further into how they define sexuality and gender, and also I would look into their position class-wise. They like elite person. Andrei had also been working in the Danish colonies in the Caribbean, for example, and Hertzberg was a politician for the Conservative Party. So I hope to make sense of this. This story of them forming their identity at the same time trying to understand them as social persons and elite persons in the society.
So now we heard their research and where they'd like to go, time and resources being there. Could I have some questions? Yes.
I have a question for Olaf. It's about the library, and you said that the library catalog was online, it was on a computer, but it was lost. But that library is quite old, right? So I was wondering if there were any paper card catalogs or lists before the computer was used, and if they survive anywhere, that might help you to reconstruct what was there.
No, it's the short answer for the card catalog. Not that I'm aware of, I haven't been told, I've asked, and they said no. What does exist is the book lists from the bookstore in the 80s, 90s. So we know what was in the bookstore, and that's in the library. Mm-hmm. But the older, there's also the membership publications from ARTSA, where members could get books by mail. Those lists exist as well, but they're not complete.
Another question? Yeah, in the back.
Can some university help put it up? I actually have a more of a sharing of a story. 25 years before the Malibu fire, there was a huge fire in Orange County. 441 homes were destroyed, and the fire went over the hills and almost went to my campus, and they were about to evacuate the campus. And I heard about it, and a friend of mine told me there were these two gay couple who had been together even in the 50s mm-hmm. and 60s, and Kinsey had interviewed them, mm-hmm. and they had a studio. And so all the photographs, one was a photographer, all the photographs were burned down. So I went there the next day. The fire was still burning, you know, still hot. And I had all these lenses on my shoulder, and the cops had waved me through. They thought I was a press. And so I didn't even talk to them. They just saw me and they waved me through. So I went and took pictures. And then a week later, I found out where they were living. They had moved out because their house was burned down. So. And their motorbike had burned into a clump. It was a clump of steel. They had a motorbike outside. So I went with them back to the premises and looked for stuff. And I saw this picture of a naked guy from an ad from Advocate. It was all burned around it, and just the picture of the naked person was sitting on a piece of rock. And so I took a picture of it. And when I turned around, it had blown away. So it's so ephemeral, you know, all this stuff. I mean, memory is also fragile, but physical items that are from the fire are really ephemeral, and most people don't save it, they toss it. But I think I'm happy I did a picture of it, and I ended up with a student from UCI, I went to interview the couple, so I do have the memories of the collection and market things and so I think oral histories are really a way to capture some of this, this transient stuff. And this was a couple from the 50s, in the 50s or 60s, and 50s maybe. And so Kinsey was interested how long they were together at that time. So it's not, this gay marriage thing is may not be new.
I'm going to ask you to bring that to a close. Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm sure that we all have things that we could share, but I'm going to ask that the questions be more directed to the work that has been presented. But that is a great story. Thank you. But we'll now focus on the work being presented.
John, is there any initiative, have you heard of any initiative among the people you went with back to Malibu to actually start collecting material, because there must be tons of material stretched out across everybody who's ever attended one of those things. Initiatives to actually...
Yeah, I think like in these kinds of scenarios, it's survival, and I think the organization is just trying to get back on their feet in terms of what they have and what they don't. And I imagine, you know, if you polled the different members, that, you know, that would be kind of archival work in itself. But I think because it's so recent, and the organization is just still just trying to figure out how to take the next step and get a camp going, I guess. Yeah.
While you're thinking, I have a question for Carolyn, which is, has the Lesbian History Archives heard your paper? And
Joan has. I gave a similar version to the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives and the Queer Solidarities Conference last year. And then Joan asked if we could use some of it for the Herstory Archives publication, Sinister Wisdom. So that will be coming out. So So some of them have heard it.
Mm. And what was the reaction from the collective to be?
I don't know about the whole collective, but like Joan wanted it recorded. And yeah, because Joan's so into multiplicity in voices and, you know, like looking and staring at places where things are dislocated and we see contradictions, not purity in our heritage. But, you know, one of the things that Joan often says about collecting archives is take it all. Don't try and make our heritage look more pretty than it is, because it's not. So that, yeah. So she, yeah.
So just the Lesbian Story Archives is in Brooklyn, but Joan Nessel, the founder, has since moved to Australia. So
and in Melbourne, so
yeah. So that's who she's.
Question?
Yes.
Yes.
mine is for Olaf, if I may please. You mentioned the loss of the 1977 first edition of the Swedish The Front Runner with illustrations by Thomas Finland. How many was in the original publication of that book? I mean, how many
copies
were originally printed for the first
that
edition?
I don't know. We have duplicates now.
You do have duplicates.
But I haven't seen anywhere else.
Mm. Okay. Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, one thing that struck me from the papers is not just that these things exist, but they exist because people know how to pass them on, so that they, you know, the library knows to contact somebody about these letters that they found, because mm-hmm. there's a profile. Same with you, you know, but the Royal Library doesn't know, doesn't recognise it when it sees it. And I'm wondering about how we go about, well, right, we're doing it, but I wonder what it is we're doing that makes that possible. That the big institutions really need us, mm-hmm. and how we can strengthen those kind of relationships.
Is that for everybody, or
yeah,
is
anybody?
Anybody? So, how do the big institutions know about us, or how do we strengthen those connections so that they reach out if they have? Because those statistics were pretty stunning, but so little was duplicated, right? So, to anybody can take that question.
I can just say that some years ago there was an initiative in Norway by some veteran gay activists and lesbian activists to deliver material from organizations and private persons to the National Archives. And the National Archives, they started a project doing that, but it wasn't enough, and they got in a couple of archives from private persons, almost nothing like this. That was kind of disappointing. I think what we have experienced is that there are so much material there. We have collected hundreds of shelf meters and linear shelf meters, and there are a lot of stuff there. But you have to be out there. You have to be active. You can't just put up, okay, the National Archives are collecting free material, and people will come. But that won't happen. So I think you have to really, really work hard, and you have to be at pride events, you have to be where people are.
Mm-hmm. May I respond to that also,
yes.
please?
Mm-hmm.
Because my collection that I work with is part of a university, a state university, a rather large one, and how come our collection ended up in the state university? Because our university, our historical society, all of that wasn't interested in collecting even gay and lesbian materials that came from the state. The university got a grant from a single individual, gay individual, that worked with the computer company for $500,000 to start a gay and lesbian program where they actually taught gay and lesbian history. The university wanted that $500,000. And once they started it, the two directors of that program said, we can't have a program without an archive and a library. And so that came to me and said, would you be interested in donating your collection? There was a lot of resistance, both within the university and within the GLBT community, because nobody trusted anybody. But we wrote a super strong contract. And the university, because of the money, agreed to every single word in the contract.
Did any of the other panelists want to take that question?
I could say something very brief about our situation in Gothenburg with collaborations, partly like basically the community, where many of those who are active in Cura have backgrounds as queer activists, and those connections and networks are really important for getting materials in. And then we're also very fortunate to have a working collaboration with the State Archives in Gothenburg, where they give us shelf space and an office room. But the collection is still ours, we maintain control of it. Because often I think collaborations with institutions from a grassroots organizations tend to, there's a risk of exploitation, practically, where the grassroots movements do the work and the institutions have the money and the resources and take advantage of the competence and work of grassroots.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
Something I've heard from all four presentations has just been the sort of like the longitudinal nature of archives and collecting, like whether it's with Radcliffe Hall, somebody now is making a claim that somebody in the future may not. The ownership is contested over a long period of time. Same with the books in Olaf, in your collection. What's valuable now is not what's going to be valuable in the future, and presumably was not what was valued in the past when the books were originally collected in that original collection. So I'm just wondering if maybe you could all comment just on how you see the work that archives are doing or need to be doing just to be securing the value for future people accessing your particular sources and works.
That's a great question.
Did it sound like a question?
It did. I think it's a really good question because I think it raises the issue of how history and experience is always located in time and space. Probably. And what is valuable does change. But you're hoping that's why collect what they collect. I mean, who knew that the matchboxes that you collected in all the saunas was going to be something that Alga would want? That kind of thing. And it will tell a story. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you don't know what story it's going to tell. It's like, you know, if you go to the New York Library and there's so many ACT UP archives, minutes of meetings, people's shopping lists, you know. And I think one of the things, someone mentioned Derrida earlier, but one of the things is that you don't know what is going to be valuable. Mm-hmm. It all is. And you know, this is why I love the Herstory Archive saying, you know, in memory of the voices we've lost, because a lot of it is about the blanks, the spaces, and what we can never know. Mm-hmm. So I think if you work knowing that it will change, knowing that there's gaps, knowing that you haven't got complete control of it, that actually changes the way in which you collect and write. You know, always keep that little space open. And, you know, at the same time, don't think that you've got the final word on somebody's identity or the value of their letter or any one of those things. But yeah, so thanks for that.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question, John. There's the center that he talked about had many, many different groups meeting, not just Seaman. And one of those groups was Blue, Black Lesbians United, and they have a similar event retreat once a year, and the same kind of grief and loss and meaning happened around all of Blue's things, and many different groups met there.
Yeah.
I mean, religious groups, probably some that were not amenable to LGBT, and people that are very amenable. So I wondered if you had thought about putting any of that in context, the other groups, or...
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned that idea where, you know, we asked the camp to take, you know, photographs and stuff, because what the camp, my reading is that the camp wanted to control access to memory. And so, and there was a particular narrative that needed to be put out there, because they have to raise funds, they all these different things, and to include an LGBTQ organization as part of that story might be a bit difficult in terms, I mean that would be one reading of it, but then the other reading is that I think in doing so it is very damaging to our the community and our history, and that's a grievable kind of thing.
Because it's probably a group of 50 to 100 groups that met and are going through the same type of experience. Other questions? Anyone have another question? Probably have time for one or two more.
A quick question for you, Carol. Thinking about some of these uncomfortable histories that we might not... that might be sort of elided by the sort of the stories that we want to tell from archives. Mm. I'm wondering, I suppose following on from that earlier question, how do you see the sort of the role of a scholar in dealing with some of these uncomfortable histories and reassessing some of the more problematic politics in a world that's sort of hopefully politically progressing in different ways?
Yeah, we have to bring them to the surface. And we have to talk about them because they keep repeating. And I think one thing that makes me really sad in queer heritage or any kind of heritage really is like trying to tell a normative story or trying to make ugly politics look pretty. And it's not. And I think we've got a better chance of progressing politics when we tell it as best we can with all of its conflict. And it's not always pride. It's really good to talk about the way in which pride and shame are both part of our heritage, and then to actually reaffirm what you want to keep, and then to be able to say, well, for all that Radcliffe Hall has offered all of these other people, there are good reasons to question Radcliffe Hall, or for whatever Magnus Hirschfeld, for instance, might have given us to think about our histories and sexuality and gender, we do have to reckon with what it means that this person has also got ties to eugenics. And what thinking made that possible to, and to sit there at the same time? I think it's a responsible thing to do, to bring it all up. I think we've got a better chance of making a better world by having it out there than by suppressing it.
When I interviewed Joan for my book, and I was about bar culture in the 50s in the U.S., and she said several times to me during our long interview, don't romanticize it. Do I have other question? Well, maybe this might be our last question. I wanted to start with Olaf and say, if you could find anything, I mean, sometimes you don't know what would be, right, because you haven't found it yet. But is there things like, finding a letter from Radcliffe Hall that you didn't think existed that opens up this whole area is pretty amazing. Is there, if each of you could, is there something that, if you could find it, if it was out there, what would it be?
We actually have a long list.
We didn't prep this question ahead of time.
On our Facebook page last Christmas, we had like Christmas calendar with 24 windows, and each day was like, we want this. So go check our webpage.
What was on December 25th?
Did you get it? Because I followed that.
Yeah, I actually found one of the... transcripts of radio talks. But I found that.
Other people? Carolyn, anything?
I was quite taken when you showed I can't even remember what year it was, but something that challenges what we take. They didn't think like that then, but they did. They could have, but there's always that sort of thing that. Something that we take for granted now, we couldn't think of
non-binary people, for instance, then I reckon there'd be evidence that there was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. John?
Yeah,
you'd like to find the rest of the boxes.
Maybe just the more broader question for me is, you know, rather than just hoping to find something, that I hope that the community continues to grow its rituals. Mm-hmm. So if, say, material objects are lost, that we are also living different ways culturally, and that are in itself artifacts of a community. So.
And I've heard that from many other groups, like the loss of geography.
Yeah.
Where do we meet now?
Yeah.
Did you want anything that
I'm not sure where to start, so I think we leave it there.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate your attention, and let's give the panel a hand.